This is an interview with Martha McKay conducted by Belinda Rigsby in Chapel Hill, North Carolina on March 29, 1974. Ms. McKay is a prominent women's leader in the Democratic Party of North Carolina and founder of the North Carolina Women's Political Caucus. Belinda Rigsby is a graduate student at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro.
What do you think were the major reasons for the defeat of the Equal Rights Amendment?
Well, it's somewhat complicated. I think that probably the majority of legislators simply didn't want to have to be recorded on it one way or the other. I think it would have passed, gone on through, if groups of preachers and women who were making a lot of noise were opposed to it hadn't gone down. They started lobbying against it. I mean, it had not appeared to be controversial when it first was introduced. And I think if we could have gotten it. Of course, we didn't. We knew it had been fought in other states, but I think, we tried to get it up as soon as possible. But at any rate, they came down there. And I think once it became, somewhat controversial, that the fact of the matter was that the majority didn't want to have to vote one way or the other. The Democratic leadership tried to provide them with an out. It was not, I believe that had nothing to do with whether they were for it or against it. And because the Democratic leadership, i.e. Ramsey through Watkins, requested Tom Sawyer, Greensboro, to put in a bill which would, calling for a referendum. And that wasn't because they wanted to give the people an opportunity to vote. If they wanted to give the people an opportunity to vote on issues of real concern to the state, they do a referendum on coastal issues and things like that, like they do in California and other states, and no fault. I mean, we're getting nothing. There are special interests around the legislature. And it was just an out for them. Lies directly at the feet of the Democratic leadership. Then beyond that, The Women's Political Caucus and the ERA Ratification Council, which had a number of women's organizations as a part of it.
Was that part of the caucus?
We formed it, and then and we paid for it. There were many women's groups that were in there. Yeah. Federated Women's Club, League of Women Voters, AAUW. Association of Women Deans in North Carolina, Secretaries, North Carolina Secretaries Association, United Church Women, just about, every women's organization of significance in the state. But we, the caucus, and a lot of those women were, of course, BPW, of course, they were in there, business and professional women. They've been working, educating their membership on the Equal Rights Amendment for 15 or 20 years. And they were a big help in terms of trying to work, do something with the legislature. And then present and past women party officials helped, working the party route. And what happened was a great deal of pressure was put on the House to defeat the referendum bill. You see, we had extra work to do that we didn't count on. And I think one reason that it was thrown from the House to the Senate was that we were too successful in that effort, because they expected it to be about even Stephen. Even a few days before, they were saying was about 50-50. And, but they thought it...
The referendum bill was 50-50?
Well, that, you know, yes. That's what people in the legislature were telling us. Give or take a few, with the weight being thrown to the side of defeat of the referendum bill. The vote, however, was something like 86-32, and I think that I don't know whether to use the word scared. Scared on that the women knew how to use the tools of politics that effectively. I mean, when you begin to move toward, you know, the real challenge of power, those who have the power get challenged. Yeah. I mean, the real channels of power is what I started saying. And I think that probably, I never went over there and interviewed people, but my guess would be that was a little surprise that wasn't accepted cheerfully in all quarters. Because what they did immediately was to throw it to the Senate. And they did that by subterfuge. I call it subterfuge. I don't know what they would call it. But the... they persuaded the people who were working for the bill in the House, and mainly those who were on the House committee that would have to vote it out, that the chairman of that committee was ill, and that the vote, the 82-36 vote or whatever, he was against the bill, thanks to Judge Susie Sharp.
I've run into her in my research.
Yeah, well, this guy told me. You told me.
When it was this Folger, no, Senator Folger was head of the Senate committee. It was Kitchen Josie. Yeah.
Kitch is a nice guy, and I've known him for years. But he was against it, and he told me that Susie Sharp's opinion influenced him more than anything else.
And that was brought up at the February 8th hearing, which the letter was read. Was that the main expression of her opinion?
She made some telephone calls.
Oh.
This is my understanding. Now, she didn't tell me, but I understood him to say that she'd made a telephone call. At any rate, I believe Kitch Josie was originally from, I know he used to live in Greensboro before he moved east. And it seems to me maybe he'd lived in Reedsville for a while, which is where Susie Sharp is from. And it is my understanding, and I didn't bother to track it down, that she did make some telephone calls. I would not swear to it, but that's my understanding, and my memory is that I heard more than one person say that she had made some, quote, discreet, unquote, telephone calls. At any rate, Kitch Josie has had a couple of heart attacks, but he was able to run for the legislature and was serving.
Yeah.
And they persuaded the one of the very nice legislators who was helping steer the bill through the House, or trying to, that of course they put him in a box, and I'm sure he consulted with others, but they put him in a box, that Kitch Josie the vote had been a big blow to him, and that he'd had a couple heart attacks, and that he just wasn't able to call his committee meeting on the following Friday, and the vote was on about a Wednesday. I believe. So, as soon as that young man told me that, I said, "You've been had." And, however, I couldn't, what can you say? I mean, you know, there's a kind of courtly gamesmanship that goes on, and you don't question somebody. They say someone is ill and they wish to. Of course, Charlie Phillips from Greensboro said that he would have. In other words, that he would have questioned that. Well, too bad. Uh-huh, let the vice chairman. Kitch Josie doesn't have to be there. Let the vice chairman run. Too bad. I'm sorry he's sick. we'll have the meeting anyway. Someone who'd had more experience, you know, like I said, Charlie Phillips. Charlie from Greensboro?
Yeah, he's...
I believe he made that comment.
Yeah.
He made that comment that he would, you know, that was just really wild, that they should have just said too bad. But,
Okay.
Well, at any rate, as I say, with a more experienced legislator, and however this young man is young, it's only his second session, he has ambitions, you know, to either stay in the legislature and work up the ladder or run for statewide office or something, and you just don't throw your weight around as even a sophomore legislator, you kind of... So I understand that his... Besides, he accepted it as genuine, you know. And it just didn't occur to him to say what, you know, he just hadn't had the experience to come back with what Charlie Phillips later said what he would have done, what this girl should have done. So at any rate, they got by with it. They just strictly got by with it, because you see, it would have passed in the House, clearly. Although we know there were some people who voted against the referendum bill because they felt that it was wrong. They had been told very clearly in testimony that it was the duty of the legislature to vote.
I think John Sanders mentioned that
in
his speech.
Yes, he did. Yes. He didn't mention much, but he mentioned that.
Yeah.
And so that was very clear that it was their duty, and that it didn't, no matter how the state voted, they would have to take a vote on sooner or later. So it really hadn't, of course, we knew it didn't have anything to do with that. They were just trying to get out from under. So then they pulled this maneuver, and...
So that prevented them, by copping out, say, with the referendum, it prevented them from bringing it back up in the House before the Senate...
Back up? It hadn't been up.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, putting it before the floor of the House.
Right. And they were sure by the 86-32 vote, as we were,
that it would pass.
And as I say, the whole thing was, I guess we better give the boys an out. Those were the words used when Sawyer was asked to put the referendum bill in. And so, since that didn't give them an out, they had to give the boys an out by saying that Kitch Josie wasn't able to hold his committee meeting. It was due to come up that day, and without question would have been referred out that day, which meant that it would have gotten to the floor of the House the next week. Since that it wasn't held that day, I believe the Senate committee either met that very same day or shortly thereafter,
yeah.
And they voted it out. And
it
we had it.
The very next day following the referendum vote that the Senate...
Yeah, that's what it was. The House committee, I believe, had been scheduled to meet on Thursday. I remember now, because it was Thursday night that I got the message that it had been postponed, and it was Friday morning that I called up Richard and asked him what the hell happened, you know, about 7:30. Or maybe he called me that night, doesn't matter. At any rate, then the Senate committee met on Friday, and I believe it was voted out by 8-7 favorable
mm-hmm.
majority. And but you see, the House knew we were worse off in the Senate than we were in the House. They knew that. The Senate, all year long, last year and this year, has been, as H.L. Mencken used to say, a Sahara. I mean, it's just been devoid of leadership, character, you know, the whole schmear. They've been perfectly awful. I mean, the legislature hadn't been good, but the Senate's been dreadful. Also, we hadn't worked on the senators. We had worked on those committee members very hard to get a favorable vote,
mm-hmm.
because a bill that doesn't get a favorable vote is hardly ever voted on favorably, and certainly they would have used that for an out on ERA. But we worked very hard on the committee, But we had not lobbied the senators. We had spent, I don't know, 5 or 6 weeks or whatever the time period was, doing nothing but working on House members. Nothing. I mean, I couldn't tell you what I could pull out my, you know, that's the thing I had, you know, marked. Nothing. You know, I had to, we just went over them and over them and over them. And, sure,
things are beginning to fall in place now.
Sure, I mean, I called people like Pat Taylor, see? I had there, that was my call, Pat Taylor to call Hightower. I mean, we used everybody. I mean, of course, we know how to do it. We've been doing it for years. They just, you know, we just haven't gotten credit for it. If I would pull out my phone bill 1 month was $300. And I, you know, I didn't, we raised money. Fortunately, we raised money. So, not talking about I had to pay for this one, although I paid for plenty, but I imagine that I called at least $600 worth. And see, we had, Locke, she's a Republican woman, Pat. He was assigned to her, and then she reported back, okay, Locke, no. And, see here, I marked them this. This one signed yes. See, we sent out things. Over 50% of them were signed yes before they walked in the door. And we know who signed and then who chickened, which is a kind word for it. At any rate, he signed yes, signed yes. Signed yes, this one signed yes, Samuel Owen.
Would you comment on Mike Mullins and Gordon Allen's backing out?
Sure.
In the last minute.
Okay, just let me finish that sentence. So then we hadn't done all that work, I mean, as you can see. And so we were fearful. However, we went to work. We went to work on the Senate. And we worked. We didn't have it about 5 days. And we worked like dogs. And we had it. When they walked in there, we had it 25-25. And they knew it.
And you believed that you had it. I mean,
we did have it. We had their commitments. We can't help if they're liars. You know, they're not honorable men. Gordon Allen wrote a constituent and said, I intend to vote. I haven't made up my mind all this time, and I intend to vote when it comes up for ERA. And he'd wrote that the weekend before. On Saturday night before that vote, we had it. As a matter of fact, we had it 27. We had 27 on Saturday night. Well, two that had been kind of wavering, flaked out before Wednesday. One of those that we thought we had a chance with was Barker, the Democrat Barker from Wake County, and he flaked out. We found out, you know, that morning, and somebody else that we thought we had flaked out.
So that would still have been 25, though.
When they walked in the door, it was 25-25. Mullins had given his commitment, and so had Gordon Allen, in writing. So, I tell you exactly. See, you understand that the issue of the Equal Rights Amendment had nothing to do with it.
Yes.
Gordon Allen did not want to make Jimmy Hunt a hero. Jimmy Hunt had already announced he was going to break the tie, right?
In favor.
That's right. And by that time, Allen must have realized that every woman who'd ever worked in politics practically was for the ERA. Every organization, the women who worked the system were for ERA. The ones, you know, who were against it, we never heard of them before or since.
It's true.
The woman who headed up was a proud and avowed member of the John Birch Society. And they don't run politics in North Carolina. So I think it was very simple. Gordon Allen did not want to make Jimmy Hunt a hero. And he, again, he went over. I saw him go over to Dean, Charlie Dean, and you know, kneel down and start talking to him on the floor. And then I saw Charlie put his head down. And of course, what he was doing was telling that
he was
going to change his vote.
if you had been
If I'd been Charlie, and I don't criticize Charlie, I mean, I never, everybody has to operate in his or her own way. But I'd have said, Gordon, you gave me your word, and I'm really going to ask you to keep it. That's part of the rules, too. You can do that. He had to release him. Of course, it's usual that people do release people, but with the 25-25, I said, sorry, Gordon, I've helped you on this bill and that bill, and I want you to, I'm asking you, I will not release you. I figure myself that Mullins would never have had the nerve to switch if Allen hadn't switched. He was a freshman. And I may be wrong, but I figured that he wouldn't have.
Well, was there any visible sign of Mullins the way you say Gordon Allen went over him? And talk to Charlie.
No, because see, Mullins is a Republican.
Yeah.
And I tell you the truth, I don't know who was keeping up with the Republicans. Taylor was with us. Charles Taylor.
Mm-hmm.
He's the minority, or he was. I guess he still is the minority leader. See, I had him marked okay. And at any rate, I don't know. I can't say. I would question. I feel myself that if Gordon, and of course he's the, I think Alfred's the first name and Allen is the second. He's the second name called. And I question whether or not Mullins would have gotten up there and been the one to caused the defeat of the Equal Rights Amendment. But I think Gordon's reason is very, very simple. He has had interest, so it is said, an interest in running for governor. We all know Jimmy Hunt's running for governor. And he would have made Jimmy Hunt a hero. I think it's about that simple.
Well, what would you do, or what will you do next time in 75 differently?
Well, of course, we hope there's a chance it'll be passed. I don't know how many more legislatures that could pass it or have it yet to come up this year. I don't know. I just haven't given that a great deal of thought. We'd have to take a. I hope the caucus will send out next fall. Letters like we did, you know, asking people to sign and return. Although, of course, there's nothing you can do if they don't stick with it. I suppose, you see, when we didn't even start working until we could have started working on election day or the day after as soon as we found out who was elected. We didn't because we actually was a tactic to keep quiet about it. And we decided that the less said, the better. We did not know whether Schlafly would, you know, start her big assault in North Carolina, although she had in Florida and other places that I knew about. But then we couldn't. And I suppose what we would do would be to just get going earlier. I mean, basically what causes a legislator to take a position on an issue is the folks back home. And that's the way we worked, you know, the lobbying. I wasn't calling those people. We were getting their home folks to call them and write them. And as a matter of fact, a legislator from a coastal county said that his mail had changed, you know, dramatically from con to pro after we started working. And I guess we would just start that process earlier. And I hope that not only a letter next fall, but I hope that the women who are asked to work for those candidates will ascertain whether or not they favor the Equal Rights Amendment before they agree to work for them in the fall election.
Well, with this in mind about getting the folks back home behind it, what efforts did you make, or did the Women's Political Caucus make, to inform the housewife and the woman of the lower socioeconomic levels of the meaning of the ERA?
Well, most all of us are housewives.
Yeah.
So I don't know who you call a housewife. You mean a housewife that's not working?
No, I'm really stereotyping some of the people that came down anti
ERA.
Well, I'm a housewife, and Betty McCain's a housewife, and Julia Miller's a housewife, and most all of us that worked on it are housewives.
Well, I mean, just the lower socioeconomic levels, and maybe some of the not so
we got
well educated.
We have had on our policy council since the very beginning Pat Wingler, who's head of women's activities for COPE, and we have had on the board at that time, I believe, we're on the policy council, a woman who's I believe she's an officer in the Meat Cutters Union, and Elsie Hale from Fayetteville.
Came across her name.
And then there was a union that was working for us up in Asheville. They wrote me and they were putting out stuff up there, and I can't remember the name of it, but they were awfully good about it. So we had the unions working. We didn't, of course, you don't ask Welfare Rights Mother to take her money and make a long distance call to the legislature. I mean, they're, for most of them, it's a matter of survival. They simply don't have the means to operate the way middle class people do. I wouldn't say we've made any concerted effort to go after the low income just for that reason.
Did you get any support from those areas? If you talked to those people, did they, they did understand?
Well, I couldn't speak for the group as a whole, but the ones I know did.
And they weren't afraid of these things like being drafted or having to go to the bathroom with me?
Are you talking about the low income people?
Yeah. Some of the people, it seems to me that there was a group of people that didn't really know what it was all about.
Well,
and
that's true.
And they were, this is where the emotional issue became
involved. That's true. Involved. Well, and that came from the preachers.
The fundamentalists.
Mm-hmm. That's right, Bible Belt. Up in the mountains, I'm sure the mountain people were against it, probably. You know, the average person, and that's quite low income. And it's very hard also to communicate. Up there, you know, they just don't have the transportation and the, you know, clusters of population that we have in Piedmont. But I'm sure there was a great deal of ignorance about it, and fostered by the Baptist preachers. And of course, as far as I know, the Roman Catholics are against it. And I don't, but Roman Catholics, there was another organization in this country, I forget the name of it, it was headed up by a Roman Catholic woman. Of course, the Schlafly's Roman Catholic.
It could have been Happiness of Women.
I believe that's it.
H-O-W.
That's right. And they were all into the Catholic thing about it was contrary to the wishes of the Mother of God and stuff like that. And it is thought by some people that some conservative elements in the Roman Catholic Church gave them money. I never, you know, I didn't see any formal activity on the part of the Roman Catholic Church down here.
Well, you have partially answered this one. If maybe you want to add, is there anything else that you could tell me about the political scene as far as political deals going on, trading of votes?
No, Julia Miller would know more about that. She worked over there every day. As far as trade-offs were concerned, we all of us came to the conclusion that when push came to shove, that only women put women's issues first. I would say that's probably true with very few exceptions. I don't know of any who traded or failed to trade, but I would guess that, I mean, we know certain people were pushing certain other bills, and they're saving their green stamps for their bills. And I just don't think many to trade on this bill, except the women. And, of course, that did not include Betty Wilkie. The women in the House were, of course, worked hard, and were all of them were for it.
To what extent do you think legislators really understood the issue? Did they make an attempt to understand?
I think many of them were ill-informed, and we did our best to get them informed. We tried to play even that low key. Elizabeth Peterson, who's a lawyer, and a woman who's at Duke, I believe she teaches medical law, I believe. She was on call. Plus, I believe a man from the Duke Law School.
plus a couple of lawyers in Raleigh. And we tried as best we could. Of course, you see, when we got there toward the end, we were working under a terrible time behind. Because you see, the referendum vote had nothing to do with the legality or what would happen or anything else. But in terms of making personal appointments with people who seem not to understand and who seem to be willing to listen, we did the best we could with the lawyers who were willing to go. Marissa Schoonmaker was, I don't know that she made trips to Raleigh, but she was trying to help as best she could from Winston-Salem. Yeah, I think it's fair to say that there were fears that were unjustified, and that there was a good deal of either misinformation or lack of information.
Governor Holzhauser gave his verbal support. Did it make a difference? And would active support on his part have made a difference?
Yeah. Active support would have made a difference. I had it written down somewhere, but the Democrats came through better percentage-wise than the Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
A lot better in the Senate, because it was on those we have to count. I didn't even bother to do the percentages on that 82-36 vote, but I think it's in my ERA file. I might have had it in here, I don't know. At any rate, we asked him, basically Grace Rohrer was working on that end of it, and we did ask his help, and of course he had made the statement when he made his state of the state message that he favored the Equal Rights Amendment, and when he was asked if he was going to work for it, he said no, that he wasn't, that he was going to work, you know, according to his priorities, and or some statement to that effect. However, I think if it would have made a difference if we could have got to him a little sooner. We asked him to, he was out of town, he went out of town just about the time of the vote. I think he went out on Monday. And we made an attempt to get to him, to ask him to get to just two people. And I don't know whether he did or not. I doubt.
Who are they?
I can't remember. Two Republican legislators, senators. And where we felt he could have some influence. And he was in Washington at some kind of meeting, and I don't even know whether the message got to him. But yes, he could have made a difference.
How would you assess Senator Irving's political influence on the General Assembly?
He sent one letter to everyone. A mimeograph letter. Or some kind of letter that was reproduced mechanically. And I believe saying that a constituent of mine has asked me to do this, I really started to write him and ask him, you know, which constituent. And I believe that he enclosed copies of his congressional testimony or something from the congressional record. After that one letter, I never found his tracks. I don't think he did much else. I don't think he actually lobbied. I mean, it's been the policy of people in Congress, you know, to leave the legislature alone. And although we had offers of support from some people in Congress who said they would do what they could, particularly some who had been in the General Assembly. And but I don't think Irvin, you know, lobbied. He doesn't usually operate that way. He sent the one letter, and he may have contacted a few people, but he didn't do any massive lobbying. Of course, everyone already knew he was, you know, you could almost, in a way, almost discount his influence because everyone knew where he was. You know, we've known it for years. But Susie Sharp, and then there was another woman judge,
Naomi Morris.
Morris, who was against it, and I think they probably did us more harm than Irvin.
So
I understand Naomi Morris worked actively against it.
Well, I haven't come across her name in any newspaper accounts or anything, and if there's any, do you know anything about her, where she's from?
Oh, yeah, she's from Wilson. She's a judge. You see, it's been the practice of people who are appointed to the bench to stay out of the legislature's business and out of active politics, so it is not exactly protocol for them to have messed in it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's my understanding that they did. Now, as I say, if Susie Sharp did much, she was very, very quiet about it. But after all, you can...
I believe Naomi Morris spoke at the February 8th hearing, didn't she? I think I...
There was one hearing that I was in
Houston.
Or
Winifred Wales. She's a judge, too. It might
have
been Winifred Wales.
She's a judge or a lawyer. I don't know which.
Well, she spoke anti.
Yeah.
And maybe it wasn't Naomi Morris then.
I don't know, because I was in Houston at that time, and I wasn't there. I think if you're there, you tend to remember, so
yeah.
I don't remember. But I know that those two, I would say, Morris and Sharp, did hurt us.
According to the newspaper account, you told women at the convention that the state was being deluged with outside money to fight the ERA. Where was this money coming from, and what groups within the state were receiving it?
I'm not sure whether I said that or whether I think Betty Friedan said
it. Yeah,
that.
I know she said it. Or maybe you didn't say it in the newspaper account. Credited you with the comment.
I said, you know, we knew that it had happened in other states,
mm-hmm.
and that we assumed, I may have said we assumed it was happening here. I don't know. I saw someone not long ago, the first place, the women reporters told us that their papers would not give them the time and money to really try to investigate that, including, you know, big papers, New York Times, Post, and so forth. I saw someone not too long ago, and I can't remember who it was, that said that definite tie-in had been made, maybe in Oklahoma, where Hargis operates. Now, I'm not saying it was from Hargis, but it wouldn't surprise me if he hadn't put money into it. But conservative money, and, I mean, Slafly, they've never been able to pin her down, and she spends a lot of money. Betty Friedan went to Kentucky and found that women had been brought in and put up at motels and so on and so forth, you know, to fight ERA. And of course, the question was, where did the money come from? I don't know whether, as I say, I saw someone not too long ago who said they had actually made the connection and had actually found that either John Birch Society or Birch-type organizations had put money. And as I told you, I also had heard the conservative Roman Catholics had put money into it. I had never seen any article or anything that actually documented it.
Yeah. What effect did Betty Friedan's appearance at the convention have on the controversy, if any?
I would think it'd probably be a net plus, although she said one thing that is not what you call good PR. That is, she said, you know, if they don't vote for it, go out and beat them. I mean, you don't say that before you take a vote, you know. You don't threaten. And but the reason I say it was probably a net plus is because I suspect that the women who heard her went out and did more than they would have otherwise in terms of working for it, really getting involved. Because that's the only thing where she said something she shouldn't have.
What about Phyllis Lafley's appearance before the legislature, or her influence on the legislature?
Legislators tell me that, and lobbyists too, that people appearing in the hearings don't change bills and don't change bills, they don't change people's positions. That's what they tell me. I don't know. I haven't been in the legislature, but they say, but it doesn't really make any difference as far as the legislators are concerned. I suppose one possible way, if you have some very dramatic testimony or something and it gets in the newspapers and the constituents start putting pressure on, that it would make a change. But that's what they say.
What was your opinion of the media coverage of the controversy?
Well, there were only a couple papers that really were trying to, you know, not only do a good job, but trying to help. The Asheville paper had an excellent editorial. I believe, and I'm not sure about this, it seems to me, I get mixed up, there have been so many stories, that maybe the Durham paper wrote a good series about it.
The Charlotte Observer, I think, wrote a good editorial.
Yeah, the Charlotte paper had a good editorial.
Well-informed.
Yeah, the Charlotte paper. But they didn't do anything like what other papers in this country did. Well, I'm not talking about all other papers. They didn't do anything like what some good papers did in this country. I have something in there, I think. I'll show you if you want to see it from Seattle or somewhere like that, where they did a whole supplement on the Equal Rights Amendment, the history of women's suffrage and possible ramifications and so on and so forth, why the News and Observer didn't even have a series. Mm-hmm. And I don't even think they were for it. They had some kind of, they backed into some kind of mealy-mouthed editorial, but I think they could have done a service by, because there was so much misinformation and so much misunderstanding, but they didn't, basically. As I say, those two had a good editorial, but these papers should have run a good series. I mean, you know, the Equal Rights Amendment has been coming up in Congress for 30 years, so it isn't exactly something that came on them overnight.
Well, in one newspaper, I believe it was the Wilmington paper, I noticed an article mentioning the National Organization of Women's Fight for Lesbian Rights, and it was very near, you know, an ERA article. Do you think things like this had an effect on the issue?
Well, one somebody did with, I think it may have, but not just because it appeared in the paper. It was in the News and Observer right under, or right over, an ERA story. And what some, benighted soul did was to cut out the, now, story and Xerox and send a copy to every legislator. And of course I think the juxtaposition probably hurt. Now I really don't know whether the person cut out both stories and Xerox both, or whether they just Xerox the Now story. Of course, if you read the Now story, you found out that it wasn't Now as an organization, but it was one workshop had come up recommending that, you know, that the women's movement take on the lesbian fight, or however it was they put it. And many men don't know the difference between Now and the Women's Political Caucus and so on and so forth. So I expect that did. The fact that it was sent to every legislator may have done some damage. I don't know. Again, I would have to question whether it may have reinforced some negative positions, whether it would have changed anybody from plus to minus. I doubt.
Do you think there is a real need for a constitutional amendment like the ERA? Is it needed as a symbol of victory for the feminist movement?
I'm not much for symbols. It's needed because the Constitution of the United States is not applied to women, who remain special categories of persons under the 14th Amendment. I don't care about the symbols. I want equality under the law.
The last question, what kind of support or involvement came from the following? College campuses, black women, men, other than legislators?
One thing we could have done that we didn't do, and we really had some men working for us, is to do what I think they've done in Florida now. They have a whole men's committee for ERAs, chaired by some man that's well known, and we should have done that. We had support from men. And you know, such as the Asheville paper with their good editorial, and as I said, some congressmen, and certainly some of the men legislators were awfully good working for it, helpful. But we should have asked some man to form a committee. That would have been very helpful, I think. And we just didn't, I guess we just, well, as I told you, you know, we were lying low and then we just didn't have much time. College campuses, no, not much. Obviously there are political activists on women's, I started to say women's campuses, on campuses, women and men. The ones who are politically active are the ones who've, you know, whose families have been in the political system or who have got interested in some way, and they always help. There was a daughter of a legislator at Greensboro who was helpful, and there were certainly people, but as, in terms of as a group, as a whole, you know, I don't think there was any concerted effort. We didn't really have time to go, you know, organize and have rallies and say, right, although we certainly put out the word, we made requests in various ways, please write home, or write, when you go home, see your legislator on the weekend, and write your legislator and say where you're from. And I think some people did that, some students. But in terms of any identifiable formal effort that they organized, no.
And black women?
We had the caucus women who were, you know, part of the telephone network. Alfreda Webb was working for it. Elizabeth Cofield was trying to help us in Raleigh.